These two verses, I mean, we could say this about all the verses in the Bhagavad Gita, but this word for word is really sweet. And if we could try to focus our mind on what are the words here and what they mean, because it's just very moving. Prapaccha, asked, cha, also, iman, this, eva, exactly like, artam, purpose, yet, that, mam, unto me, prichata, you are asking, satamaha, O great sages, Krishna anubhava, wrapped in thought of Krishna, shravane, in hearing, shraddhanaha, full of faith, mahamanaha, the great soul, samstam, death, vigaya, being informed, sannyasya, renouncing, karma, fruit of activities, trivargikam, the three principles, religion, economic development, and sense gratification. Cha, also, yat, what it may be, Vasudeva, unto Lord Krishna, Bhagavati, the personality of Godhead, Atma Bhavam, attraction of love, Dridham, firmly fixed, Gataha, achieved. Translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada. O great sages, the great soul, Maharaj Parikshit, constantly wrapped in thoughts of Lord Krishna, knowing well of his imminent death, renounced all sorts of fruitive activities, namely acts of religion, economic development, and sense gratification, and thus fixed himself firmly in his natural love for Krishna, and asked all these questions, exactly as you are asking me. Purport. The three activities of religion, economic development, and sense gratification are generally attractive for conditioned souls struggling for existence in the material world. Such regulated activities prescribed in the Vedas are called the Karma Kandiya conception of life, and householders are generally recommended to follow the rules just to enjoy material prosperity, both in this life and in the next. Why does Prabhupada just say the householders? Why doesn't he say everybody? So what are the other ashrams supposed to be doing? So the Vedic system, only the householders had some license to enjoy sense gratification. What are the other ashrams doing? They're aspiring for liberation. Okay, you could definitely say that of the sannyas ashram. They're preparing for death. Sannyas is preparing for death. What about the vanaprastha ashram? Detaching oneself from household life. It's the bridge between household life and sannyas. Also in the seventh canto it says that brahmacharis can directly enter any of the three other ashrams, so it's also a bridge from the brahmachari ashram to the sannyas ashram, if you skip household life. And what about the brahmachari ashram? What's that for? Study, to prepare for. The next ashram, which is going to be either what? Grahastha or? No, vanaprastha generally. You're generally not going to go directly from brahmachari to sannyas. Generally, you need to bridge through the vanaprastha ashram. Most of the people we call senior brahmacharis are actually in the vanaprastha ashram. Technically, in a different ashram. So why would none of those people be performing? Well, they would be performing dharma, wouldn't they? Would the brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis be performing dharma? Yeah. At least the brahmacharis and the vanaprasthas, but even some of the sannyasis. But what they wouldn't be engaging in would be artha and kama. But do you think that there are brahmacharis, vanaprastas, and sannyasis who are also involved in a kind of karmakanda in Vedic times? You don't think so? They were doing yajnas, okay. So I think it's highly doubtful in Vedic times that all of the brahmacharis, vanaprastas, and sannyasis were aiming at Krishna prema. So probably many of them were also aiming at the heavenly planets. But the main place where you're going to find the whole bulk of karmakandic activities is going to be in the household of ashram. Going on with the purport, most people are attracted by such activities. Even in the activities of their modern godless civilization, people are more concerned with economic development and sense gratification without any religious sentiments. So Prabhupada's saying, modern society, they're still getting the artha and the kama, even though they've jettisoned the dharma. As a great emperor of the world, Maharaj Parikit had to observe such regulations of the Vedic Karmakandiya section. So why is that true? Why did Maharaj Parikit have to observe the regulations of Karmakanda as the emperor? To set a good example. Yes. Did that make him a Karmakandi person? What was he actually? We talked about this yesterday in Manashiksha. What was he actually? He was actually Krishna's secret agent, yes. So he appeared to be doing the rules of ordinary dharma, but his purpose was not Karmakanda. Although it appeared like that to the general people, which was, necessary. Going on the purport, but by his slight association with Shukadeva Goswami, he could perfectly understand that Lord Krishna, the absolute personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, for whom he had a natural love since his birth, and that's the natural love here, is Atma Bhava, is everything. And thus he fixed his mind firmly upon him, renouncing all modes of Vedic Karmakandi activities. So at this point, he's giving them up even externally. At this point, when he's preparing for death, then even an external activity of doing these ordinary dharmas, he's giving up. This perfectional stage is attained by a jnani after many, many births. The jnanis, or the empiric philosophers endeavoring for liberation, are thousands of times better than the fruitive workers. And out of hundreds of thousands of such jnanis, one is liberated factually. And out of hundreds of thousands of such liberated persons, even one person is rarely found who can firmly fix his mind upon the lotus feet of Lord Shri Krishna, as declared by the Lord himself in the Bhagavad Gita 7:19. Maharaj Parikit is specially qualified with the word Mahamanaha, which puts him on an equal level with the Mahatmas described in the Bhagavad Gita. In the later age also, there have been many Mahatmas of this type, so in other words, even after the Bhagavad Gita has been spoken, and they also gave up all karmakandiya conceptions of life, solely and wholly dependent upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna. And now Srila Prabhupada is going to quote 5 verses. And if you're reading the purport in order, you may wonder why he's quoting these 5 verses. So the way to understand it is actually to go to the end of the purport. In the last sentence, Srila Prabhupada says, "So Maharaj Parikshit was perfectly right when he firmly accepted the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, renouncing all karmakandiya conceptions of life." Because somebody could argue, well, if you're just going to surrender to Krishna, you're just going to have your natural attraction for Krishna, what's going to happen to all these other things? How will you be okay? And frankly, that is the question that, practically speaking, everybody is asking. Isn't it? If I just surrender to Krishna, if I don't do anything else but just fall in love with Krishna and just surrender to Krishna, what's going to happen to, and we have a whole list, right? What's going to happen to all these things? I'm going to miss out on stuff. You know, does that mean I'm not going to enjoy peanut butter anymore? Whatever it is we want to enjoy, I won't have any happiness in life. And these were also the questions Arjuna asked in the Bhagavad Gita. These were his main doubts, wasn't it? He said, I'll have all these problems if I give up following my ordinary dharma and I just surrender to you. Then I'll have all these problems. I won't even be happy, he said. I'll gain the kingdom, but I won't be happy. And if I lose the kingdom, I won't be happy. Nothing, none of these things are going to make me happy. And I'll engage in sinful activity if I'm not following karmakanda. I won't be respecting my elders. And then he also has a lot of fear about whether or not he'll be successful, especially in the sixth chapter, where Arjuna says, this whole system doesn't appear to be very workable to me. It seems much too hard. I'm not going to be able to do it. And then he even says to Krishna, he says, what happens to the people who try this and fail? Because he's worried that, you know, if I try this, I'm not going to make it. And he said, then I'll lose everything. I'll lose everything I would have done by karmakanda, and I won't get spiritual perfection. You know, I'll just surrender to Krishna, and then all that time I could have been making money out in the world and partying and whatever will be lost. And then by the time I'm 40, I'll realize that I'm unsuccessful surrendering to Krishna, and now I'll have wasted all that time and lost my youthful life. And I'll neither have enjoyed the material world nor attained spiritual realization. Yes? Was this Arjuna's question? And this is a general doubt. I mean, why don't we just surrender? I don't know about any of you. Probably all of you have already surrendered. But, you know, in general, why don't people surrender? Because we have these fears. So that's why Srila Prabhupada's quoting these verses. So when we go through and read these verses, please don't think it's just, oh, Prabhupada's just quoting some random verses here. Now, it's especially fascinating, the first verse that Prabhupada quotes here about surrender. So we're going to read now in the purport, which is basically just Srila Prabhupada quoting verses and giving the translation. Lord Chaitanya, who is Lord Krishna himself, taught us in his Shikshastika 8, Ashishlava Pararatam Pinashtumam, Adarshanam Marmahatam Karotuva, Yata Tata Va Vedanhatulam Puto, Mat Prana Natas Tu Saevana Paraha. It's a pretty extreme verse to quote immediately as what does it mean to surrender to Krishna. The Prabhupada gives a translation. Lord Krishna, who's the lover of many devotees, in parentheses women, may embrace this fully surrendered maidservant, or may trample me with his feet, or he may render me brokenhearted by not being present before me for a long duration of time, but still he is nothing less than the absolute Lord of my heart. Srila Rupa Goswami spoke thus, Virachaya mai dandam dinabando dayamiva gatir ihava bhavata kachid anyamamasti Nipatatu satakoti nirbaramva navaba tad apikila payodas tuyate chitakena. O Lord of the poor, do what you like with me. Give me either mercy or punishment. But in this world, I have none to look to except your lordship. The Chatuka bird always prays for the cloud, regardless of whether it showers rain or throws a thunderbolt. I have a friend who has that as her favorite verse. Going on. Srila Madhavendra Puri, the grand spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya, took leave of all karmakandiya obligations in the following words. Sandhya vadana badram astu bhavato bho snana tubhyam namo bu devaha pitascha tarpana vido naham kshama shamyatam yatra kvapi nishada yadaiva kulotamasa kamsadvisha smaram smaram agham harami tad alam manye kim anye name. Oh, my evening prayer, all good to you. Oh, my morning path, I bid you goodbye. Oh, demigods and forefathers, please excuse me. I am unable to perform any more offerings for your pleasure. Now I have decided to free myself from all reactions to sins simply by remembering anywhere and everywhere the great descendant of Yadu and the great enemy of Kamsa, Lord Krishna. I think that this is sufficient for me. So what is the use of future endeavors? That's a very interesting verse. Oh, my evening prayer, all good to you. Oh, my morning bath, I bid you goodbye. I don't think we're supposed to imitate that. Yeah. I don't have to bathe anymore because I'm chanting Hare Krishna. I don't think that's it's meant to be imitated. Srila Madhavendrapuri said further, Mugdhammam nigadantu niti nipuna brantam mahur vaidika mandam bandava sanchaya jaradiyam muktadara sorara unmata daniyo viveka chatara kaman mahadambikam muktam na kshamate manag api mano govinda paraspriham. Let the sharp moralist accuse me of being illusioned. I do not mind. Experts in Vedic activities may slander me as being misled. Friends and relatives may call me frustrated. My brothers may call me a fool. The wealthy Mammonites may point me out as mad, and the learned philosophers may assert that I am much too proud. Still, my mind does not budge an inch from the determination to serve the lotus feet of Govinda, although I am unable to do it. It's also a very interesting verse. I have the determination to serve Govinda, though I can't do it. And so I don't care if anybody criticizes me, all this list. The moralist, the expert in Vedic activities, friends and relatives who just say, oh, you must be frustrated. The reason you're taking up Krishna consciousness is you're just simply unsuccessful at material enjoyment. My brothers, in other words, my family members, wealthy materialists, learned philosophers. But still I want to serve Govinda even if I'm useless at it. Okay, going on. And also Prahlad Maharaj said, Dharmata kama itiyo bihitas trivarga iksha trayi nana damao vividhacha varta manyetad etad akilam nigamasya satyam swatmarpanam swa surada paramasya pumsa. Religion, economic development, and sense gratification are celebrated as three means of attaining the path of salvation. Of these, ikshetrayi especially, i.e. knowledge of the self, knowledge of fruitive activities and logic, and also politics and economics are different means of livelihood. All these are different subjects of Vedic education, and therefore I consider them temporary engagements. On the other hand, surrendering unto the Supreme Lord Vishnu is a factual gain in life, and I consider it the ultimate truth. Bhagavatam 7.6.26. The whole matter is concluded in the Bhagavad Gita 2.41, is Vyavasayatmika Buddhi, which Srila Prabhupada himself was very moved by that particular verse. Or the absolute path of perfection. Sri Baladev Vijayabhushana, a great Vaishnava scholar, defines this as Bhagavad Archana Rupaika Nishkama Karma Bir Vishuddha Chitta, accepting transcendental loving service to the Lord as the prime duty, free from fruitive reaction. So Maharaj Pariksit was perfectly right when he firmly accepted the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, renouncing all karma kandiya conceptions of life. Papracha chaimam evartam yamman prichaita sama sattama Krishna nubhava shravane shradadhano mahamaha samstam vijnana sanyasya karma tri vargikam chayat vasudeve bhagavati atma bhavam dridam gata. O great sages, the great soul, Maharaj Pariksit, constantly wrapped in thought of Lord Krishna, knowing well of his imminent death, renounced all sorts of fruitive activities, namely acts of religion, economic development, and sense gratification, and thus fixed himself firmly in his natural love for Krishna and asked all these questions, exactly as you are asking me. So everybody wants good fortune, yes? Everybody. Nobody wants things to be inauspicious. Nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants happiness and everything to go nicely for them in their life. As Prabhupada said, in this life and in the next life. And generally speaking, people try to do this by dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Of course, moksha isn't specifically mentioned here. And particularly artha and kama. So people try to gain material wealth and prosperity and having that satisfy their senses. It's difficult to satisfy your senses if you don't have prosperity, isn't it? It's a little hard. You know, we see in some parts of the world, particularly where we go to, where a large portion of the population is living in extreme deprivation and poverty. See this especially in South Africa and in India. And you just see people living, they hardly have anything that you could call a home. It's barely a shelter from the elements. And certainly it doesn't give them any protection from temperature whatsoever. And the water that they're drinking, the water they're bathing in, the water they're using for cooking is not clean water. It's giving them so many diseases. They don't live very long, and their life is full of disease. They're not able to earn much of a livelihood. They're not able to earn much money. They can't buy healthy food. And their children don't go to very good schools. I mean, in some of these places, the children aren't educated at all. The children are having to work at a very young age without receiving any kind of an education. Of course, even in those situations, we notice they have television antennas. And many times those people are suffering so much, whatever little money they get, they spend on intoxication to try to numb their suffering. And then because of their intoxication, they engage in crime, they engage in violence. And it's a really terrible, terrible situation. So if you don't have prosperity, you can't even enjoy your senses. You can't even eat decent food. You know, we have our school in Vrindavan that I work with, the Sandipani Muni School. And there we take these children out of the slums. Right now the school's only for girls. And we give them prasadam every day. And it, frankly, the prasadam, I mean, it's good, but it's very, very simple. I think most of us would find it quite difficult to eat that prasadam as our only food every day. But for those children, it's a feast. You know, it's food. It's something to eat. So their ability to satisfy their senses is very limited without material prosperity. How are you going to do that? So therefore, people want material prosperity for the sake of satisfying their senses, not in its own right. People are not attached to, generally, unless they're a miser, they're not attached to money in its own right. They're attached to money and prosperity because it gives you the facility to buy good food and to attract an attractive mate and to build a house against the elements and so forth and so on. Not only on the gross platform, but also on the subtle platform. So if you have prosperity, then you can get an education in your area of your psychophysical nature. So these people who are very poor, they're not able, you know, if they have a propensity to be a doctor or be a lawyer or, be a financial manager, they don't have the facility to do that. All they can become is a rickshaw driver. You understand? Or all they can become is some guy on the side of the street repairing flip-flop sandals. Because they don't receive the education in order even to develop themselves psychologically and get in the occupation that would be satisfying to them, even on a mental and intellectual platform. They don't have the education to study things and to read things and have mental stimulation. And they're not in a position where anybody flatters them. Nobody ever comes and says, oh, you're such a great person. You know, they don't have the ability to do much for the good of the world. So even on the subtle platform, there's not much ability if you're impoverished. Therefore, Chanaka Pandit says, poverty drives away all good qualities. It makes one impossible, practically speaking, on the material level, to enjoy on either the gross or the subtle platform. So therefore, people are after material prosperity because they want to enjoy on the gross and the subtle platform. Now, if we think about this, we don't have time. It's already 8:15, just going through this long purport. So if we think about this with a cool head, if we think about this rationally, we'll see that good fortune and happiness are not achieved simply by enjoying the body and the mind. Whereas I think none of us would want to have a body and mind that's in misery. None of us would want to have a body full of disease or a mind full of disease. That in and of itself does not really give us satisfaction. And, you know, even the most gross materialist will ultimately agree with this assessment. Even if someone's grossly materialistic, if you say to them, if you just have, you know, good food and a nice sexual partner and nice furniture to sit on and, you know, and everybody praising you, is that enough for happiness? And how many people will say, yes, that's enough. You don't need any more. That would be a very rare person. You know, even very low-grade personalities will say, well, you know, You need something more than that. You need someone in your life who likes you. I mean, it's interesting that even criminals will often engage in charitable activities to try to feel good about themselves and do something more than that, and they want to do some good for the world or whatever. So that's really not enough. It's just not enough. And not only is it not enough, but if one thinks that is the source of happiness, one is engaged in constant anxiety and frustration. Basically, because you have to set up your life so that you have these things around you all the time. And can any of us guarantee to do that? Can we guarantee that we'll always have pleasing sense objects for our gross body and that we'll always have a pleasing situation for our subtle body? Can anybody guarantee that? It doesn't matter how rich you are and how powerful you are. It's just not possible. You can be the most wealthy, powerful person in the world, and, you know, all your empire can be destroyed by a war or by a volcano. Yes, and we see many very rich, powerful people that their lives are taken apart in a moment, don't we? And so we're always in anxiety. And then ultimately a death, of course, and everybody's facing death. Ultimately a death. We lose everything. And if our happiness is tied up with the things of this world, then we have an ultimate existential anxiety. So even if we just say, well, that's not enough, you have to have something in addition. If you even think that that's the main source of your happiness, then it's always mixed with anxiety. Srila Prabhupada says it's like sweet rice mixed with sand. You know, sweet rice mixed with sand. Or for people like me, very nice prasadam mixed with too many chilies. You know? Of course, I go some places where they think if there's no chilies, it's not food. But you can have, you know, this wonderful preparation, but if it's mixed with chilies, you just can't even eat it. You want to eat it, but you can't eat it. It's just impossible. So material happiness is like that because it's mixed with anxiety. It's also like that because it doesn't touch the real self. And Prabhupada gives the example of polishing the cage of a bird and not feeding the cage. And we all have this experience that even when you have all of these things, there's something inside that says, is that it? You know, whenever we've gotten in a position, and I'm sure we've all gotten in this position at least for a few moments in our life, we go, yes, I have what I want. And then your next thing is that it? Is that what it was? You know, Dan Rajaswami was talking about this on the retreat, that a lot of the happiness is just the anticipation. You're thinking, you know, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get this. And then you get it and you're like, that was it? It doesn't match the hype, isn't it? Right? There's all this, oh, it's wonderful, it's wonderful, it's wonderful. And you go to that place or you do that thing, you experience that thing, and you're like, yeah, that was good, but that's it? And the reason is because it's not touching the self. It's all something external. It's kind of like in enjoying, you know, the Shastra says like enjoying a dream. Or in our modern day, we could say it's like enjoying a movie or enjoying a computer game where, you know, the hero in the movie who we identify with gets something wonderful at the end of the movie, but you don't have anything wonderful. You know, so you get some sense of happiness. Oh, you know, he won the girl and he got the money. But when you walk out of the theater, you don't have a girl and you don't have any money. It doesn't actually touch you. And I remember one devotee telling me, you know, so after I watch TV, I'm more lonely than before I watched. So this is the problem with material happiness. It's the problem with identifying our fortune only in terms of something mundane. However, the vast majority of conditioned souls are not able to understand this. As Prabhupada says here, you know, there's this really kind of depressing thing that, you know, there's many, many millions of what we call fruitive workers, people working to enjoy a fruit in this world. And hardly one of them comes to a philosophical conclusion that this isn't working out. The vast majority of people are simply trying to do the same thing in a different and better way. You know, something that isn't working, it's kind of like if you try to speak to someone who doesn't speak your language and you just try to talk louder or slower or more distinctly, and it doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. We used to have all these movies of the Mahabharata and Ramayana, and we had them in Hindi with English subtitles, but we also had a copy without subtitles. And it was just on those? They're so high, we don't use them anymore. The VCR cartridge. I guess we call them a cartridge. So one time I stuck in the wrong one. I stuck in one without subtitles. It was just Hindi. And my first reaction was, I have to turn up the volume. I can't understand what they're saying. So materialistic people are basically doing that. You know, they're not satisfied, but they think, I have the wrong sexual partner. That's what the problem is. I have to get a new one. Or I have the wrong kind of sexual partner. This has become our modern society. You know. I got to get, you know, we won't go there. But, you know, I've got to change the type. I've got to change the person, or I've got to change the type, or I've got to eat a different kind of food, or I have to move to a different country, or I have to get a different job, or I have to wear a different kind of clothes, or I have to get a different kind of body. You know, if I just shuffle those things around, but they're all in the same field. You haven't removed yourself from that field. You're in the same consciousness. You're at the same set of beliefs. You haven't gone out of your box at all. But most people stay in that frame, that's who I am. I'm this body, I'm this mind, and a few people say, there's something funny going on here. That the problem is with the whole paradigm. The problem's not what food I eat or what sexual partner I have or what furniture I have or what movie I'm watching or what planet I'm on or what body I'm in. That's not the problem. The problem is I'm not this body, and the problem is that I don't have happiness in this world. That's the problem. And then of all those people, they're trying to figure it out. Well, what is the solution? Maybe just there's nothingness. Maybe I'll just be detached. Maybe I'll just merge into the light. Of all of those people, a very, very, very few figure out what's really the way to get good fortune. And those people who figure that out look like complete idiots to the rest of the world. People that are in this paradigm of good fortune and happiness comes from giving pleasure to the body and mind, or they're in the paradigm of just see the world as an illusion and be detached from it. Meditate on your breath and merge into the nothingness. Both of those sets of people look at those who found love for a personal God as defective in some way. Something wrong with them. You know, they can't get their head around it at all. And they criticize. Now, we should have to say quite frankly, this is a very difficult thing to say, but I think it needs to be said, that not all the people who are ostensibly or externally members of the Hare Krishna movement are exempt from this category. I mean, we just speak very frankly. And not all people outside of the Hare Krishna movement are not in this category. As Ravindasaru Prabhu said, it's not that all the demons are outside of ISKCON and all the saints are in it. That's not accurate. So there are saintly persons who've fallen in love with God, you know, in many traditions, which is one of the... Srila Prabhupada's mood in that regard was one of the reasons I became his disciple. That he never said, only people who follow me and only people who follow Hare Krishna movement can attain to love of God. So there are such people found in all the great traditions all over the universe. And there are people who come to the Krishna consciousness movement and take initiation and, you know, seemingly follow the rules of Krishna consciousness, but still maintain a karmakandiya or Gyanakandya mentality. And even in the movement, there'll be people who criticize you if you just fall in love with Krishna. And say, because I'm trying to fall in love with Krishna, therefore, I don't need to follow all of the nitty-gritty of Varnashram Dharma. Say, no, you have to follow everything in the Karmakanda. And you say, well, no, I don't. Oh, you're a fool. You're illusioned. You're misled. You're frustrated. Oh, you're just frustrated. You're a fool. You're crazy. You're proud. And if we can't handle that, then again we're back into the subtle body sense gratification. You understand? Then we're back into the everybody has to like me, everybody has to praise me, everybody has to tell me that I'm wonderful. So to really surrender to Krishna, my dear friends, means that the vast majority of other conditioned souls are going to find fault with you. It's one of the prices that has to be paid. That other people will look at you and say, you're wasting your life. And some of these people may be members of the Hare Krishna movement wearing tilak and neck beads. And they're going to say, what are you doing? So, moving on from that very depressing thought to what is the ultimate goal of life? What gives good fortune and how do we get it? Now that we've dealt with all the negativity, now we'll deal with the positivity. So if we're looking at this verse, we find just, it's full of this wonderful Krishna Anubhava, Shravane, Shradahana. We've already talked about Sannyasa Karma and Trivargya. Vasudeva Bhagavati Atma Bhavam Dridham. I love this word Atma Bhava, which Prabhupada translates natural love, and Atma Bhava Dridham, firmly fixed in natural love. And this is when we figure out, at least theoretically, and we love how Madhavendra Puri says, I can't do it, but I'm going to do it. This is the only thing I want to do, even though I'm a failure. Better to be a failure at this than to be a success at the illusion. Because, of course, you can't really be a failure at it, because as soon as you try to do it, immediately that trying is a success, which is very cool. So Atma Bhava, we have a natural bhava, we have a natural mood of attraction to Krishna, which is dridham, which is fixed in ourself. Rupa Goswami calls this our sthai bhava, what's fixed in us. We, the authentic self, have a natural love for the personal Lord, Vasudeva. Love means person. You can't really love God like love a light. I mean, you can say, oh, there's a sun, I love it. But, I mean, how do you really exchange love with the sun? A little difficult. But we have this natural propensity, and this natural propensity for a loving relationship, it kind of shines through little cracks, even for grossly materialistic people. Isn't it? Even for the lowest entities, in the lowest forms, even for the plants, do you know that the trees communicate with other trees and tell them when there's a problem? And then the trees work together to put out chemicals to protect each other. They have a whole social network of trees. Did you know that? So even the plants care. What to speak of the little ants that care about their group? You know, there's some affection that comes out, this tendency for affection, this tendency for love, this tendency for relationship. That kind of peeks out, even for people just working on a gross materialistic platform. So that is the essence of ourselves. That is our Atma Bhavam, who we really are, and that's the way to find satisfaction. That's where we find good fortune. That's where we find happiness. And that's something that's already fixed in us. It's not something we have to acquire, like you go and get an education, or you go and get a job, or you go get a spouse, or you go get a house, or you get a car, you get some degree in some education. It's not something you have to work for Our sadhana, my dear friend, should not be work. With ourselves as the doer to get a fruit of love of God, then we're superimposing a mode of passion model onto sadhana bhakti. Our atma-bhavam dhrita, it's already within ourselves. And that is actually what we're looking for in everything else that we do. So what is this? It's kind of a wild love. I mean, these first verses that Prabhupada quotes is, I love you, Krishna, no matter what you do to me. Now, in this world, that kind of love is very foolish and should be avoided. If you love someone in this world so much that whatever they do to you, it doesn't matter, you still love them, then you are a fool. And you probably need some sort of therapy. You need somebody to rescue you. Even if you trample me, even if you love so many other women, still I'm going to love you. You know, that's we say, I think we need to have a talk. But this is ultimately the kind of love we're looking for. Or this one, do whatever you like with me. As Rupa Goswami is saying, do whatever you want with me. Be kind to me, don't be kind to me. See me, don't see me. Love somebody else. And it's this kind of almost madness love that we look for. It shows up in this world in people's devotion to their country. People who sign up for the military and literally give their arms and legs and their eyes to their country. Isn't it? Used to be that way for people's job, not so much anymore. But used to be people were dedicated to a country for their whole life. It often shows up in the family. People are devoted to their family no matter what. Especially you see this between parents and children, but sometimes you see it between spouses. Where the parents love their children, even if the children are criminals, and even whatever the children do, they still love them. Right? Shows up with animals. You love your dog even though it's biting your neighbors. Don't take my dog. It certainly shows up for our body, doesn't it? Our body gives us, to be frank, a lot of trouble, doesn't it? Anyone have a body here who doesn't give them a lot of trouble? Requires a huge amount of time every day to maintain it, yes? If you count sleeping. And even though our body gives us mostly trouble, we still like it. You know, even if you've got some terrible disease and you're full of pain, most people are like, no, I don't want to leave the body. So this tendency to love, regardless of how we're treated, it's actually part of us. Unfortunately, it's not very appropriate if we're loving our body or we're loving our dog or we're loving our child or we're loving our country. Because it doesn't get properly reciprocated. We give everything and we get just disappointment. And so sometimes we become cynical and saying, well, I'm only going to love conditionally. No more of this unconditional love for me. Then I just get mistreated. So, you know, I'm going to love you if you treat me nicely. If you don't, forget it. I'll find somebody else. But that doesn't satisfy us because it's not what we want. So what really satisfies the soul is this total surrender in love to Krishna. And we can do that because Krishna is the super soul. He's the self of the self. He's the essence of our essence. And because he's the essence of our essence, there's no possibility of him ever harming us. That's not possible. Or not reciprocating with us. He can't. We're part of him. This was so nicely explained when the cowherd boys and the calves were stolen by Brahma, and then Krishna expands himself into, practically speaking, identical boys and calves. But the residents of Vrindavan became more attached to those replicas. And afterwards, Maharaj Parikit said, how were they more attached? And Sukadeva Goswami says, our attachment to our family is not as great as our attachment to our body, which is not as great as our attachment to our mind, which is not as great as our attachment to our self. And Krishna is the self of the self. So it's natural that our greatest attachment will be to him. So when we give that kind of love to Krishna, it's not exactly that we're giving it to an other. That's not exactly the case. Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. We're also one with him. He's our essence. So there's no question that he's going to cheat us, even when Krishna is separate from the devotees. They're feeling an ecstasy of separation. They're not feeling neglected. When Krishna tramples his devotees, they're not feeling trampled. They're feeling blessed. Like Govardhan Hill, when Krishna and Balaram walk on him, he feels, oh, Krishna and Balaram are walking on me. You know, if you imagine, if Krishna's putting his feet on you, normally if someone puts their feet on you, you know, it's an insult. That's how you treat your enemies. I walk all over my enemies. But just imagine if Krishna had his feet on you, how would you feel? Would that be nice? What do you think? So the devotee is like, well, however you treat me is beautiful. However you treat me is wonderful. Because everything that Krishna does is loving and wonderful. So that kind of love, appreciating everything. You know, we try to do that materially with other jivas, but it's not really valid. You can't really appreciate everything about another jiva. You can appreciate how they blow their nose. I mean, it's just, some things you're just like, well, what can I do? But with Krishna, everything about him is sweet. Madharadipati akilam madharam. Everything. How Krishna walks is sweet. How Krishna laughs is sweet. Even if Krishna says, hey, I want you to do a service where people are going to criticize you, would you do this for me? The devotee finds that sweet. Whatever they want to do for Krishna, they find to be sweet. And it's fully satisfying because all of the benedictions from everything else are coming from Krishna. It's like you're going to the source. Instead of going to, you know, one shop where they sell fruit and one shop where they sell automobile parts, you're going to like the big store where they have everything. You're going to Krishna and everything is included. The reason the devotees aren't interested in dharma, artha, kama, moksha is because they already have all the benefits from all those things. Not because they're like some jnani who says, that's all suffering. Because whatever a person wants by getting money, whatever a person wants by getting good food, whatever a person wants by getting fame, the person who's in love with Krishna has all that. They have the source of all. They don't need to look for it separately, and it doesn't matter whether they have it separately or not. This doesn't make any difference, because they already have the inner satisfaction that they're looking for. So the sad thing, of course, is that it's very difficult for us, having been conditioned souls for a very, very long time. Maybe some of you are Nitya Siddhas who've just come here to preach, so please excuse me, I don't mean to offend any of you. But for a conditioned soul who's been here for a long time, it's very, very difficult to trust. You know, we haven't been satisfied in the material world, but it's at least we feel we got something. And if I just surrender to Krishna, maybe he'll also cheat me. You know, maybe he'll cheat me like that girl did in high school or whatever, you know. And we're so afraid. So we like surrender partially. We kind of hold on to, I'm going to hold on to something in the world and surrender partially. And then when we even surrender partially, somebody criticizes us. Our parents or some other devotee or somebody says, what are you doing surrendering to Krishna? Don't you know what you have to do in the world? And then we think, wow, already my ego's getting attacked. Oh my goodness, you know, am I sure I want to do this? But as we surrender a little bit, we taste something that's real. Yes? We experience something that's genuine. We experience something that's Atma Bhavam, that's Krishnanubhava. We experience something that doesn't have any parallel in this world, that's of a different quality. Even if we just get a tiny, tiny, tiny drop of it, we immediately can understand, hey, there's a different quality to this. Just like the first time I ever had organically grown, locally grown, tree-ripened fruit, I was 20 years old. So the temple that we were at in New York, we were told that a local peach orchard was willing to give us the peaches left on the trees and on the ground after they've harvested everything. They were finished with the harvest, but you know, they do it with machines and they don't get everything. Or even if you do it with people, I'm sure they're going to miss something. So we went with these big crates and we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of peaches, but because it was after the harvest, they were all tree ripened. And it was an organic nursery and it was local. So we were bringing them back for Radha Govinda, and my son at the time was quite small. I don't think he was a year old. And so, of course, he sees all the peaches, and he wanted a peach. So I took one of the peaches out of the crate and offered it and gave him the peach, but he didn't finish it, as often happens with little children. They want something, and they eat it, but they don't finish it. And so I finished the peach, and I said, wow. Never in my life before have I eaten a real peach. It was just such a dramatic experience. I thought all these peaches in the store were just imitations. The same happened many years later when I grew a vegetable garden and had fruit trees. And you pick the stuff out of your garden and you cook it and you say it's a different thing. You know, it's a different zucchini. I didn't know a zucchini had this flavor. I didn't know broccoli had this flavor. And then at the end of the summer, you know, when your stock runs out and the stuff you've canned runs out and you have to go back to the shop and buy something, it's practically torture to eat this stuff. You're like, well, it's all cardboard. So my point is, we all know when we taste something that's genuine. There's a different quality to it. So when we surrender a little bit to Krishna, we get a little bit of a taste of something that's genuine. And that should give us the faith, because we have this word here too, Shraddha. He had full faith that if I just surrender to Krishna, everything else will be taken care of. And as we surrender to Krishna, we get this awakening of our Atma Bhava, our Dridham Atma Bhava, this fixed feeling that we have for Krishna. We go, wow, that's the thing. That's the thing I was looking for in the world but couldn't find. There it is. And we get a little sense of being satisfied. So we can move a little bit away from Dharma Artha Kama. And as we surrender more, we can move a little bit more away. And as we surrender more, we can move a little bit more away. And eventually we come to the point like these great acharyas, where we say, okay, I want you, Krishna. I am having so much ecstasy and so much satisfaction at your lotus feet that I don't care if I'm massaging your lotus feet or you're kicking me with them. I just want touch with you. And if the whole world criticizes me, then that's okay. Because not only do I not care for the gross things of the world, but I no longer even care for the subtle things of the world. As long as you love me, Lord, I don't care what anybody else thinks of me. Yeah. So this is the ultimate point that we want to come to. So thank you for your patience. It's always difficult with these very long purports. So questions, comments, corrections? Yes, Prabhu. The essence of surrender to Krishna is that the consciousness to please Krishna. Yes, you could say that. That's the whole essence of bhakti, is acting in a way where we only want Krishna's pleasure. So yes. Although there are six symptoms of surrender. So one can go into, you know, to accept what's favorable, to reject what's unfavorable, to see Krishna as my only ultimate protector, Krishna as my only ultimate maintainer, to always feel myself meek and humble, and to dedicate everything, my body, mind, and my very self to his service. So we can analyze surrender that way. But yeah, if you want to get to the essence of it is, I just want to make you happy just to make you happy. Which is how we would like everybody to treat us, by the way. We would like everybody that we know to want to make us happy, to want to make us happy, just because they're happy at making us happy, and not because they want to get something from us. So that's also what Krishna wants. And he, by the way, wants to make us happy just to make us happy. He's already in that mood. He doesn't have to do any kind of sadhana to bring it out. The only thing Krishna wants for us is he wants us to be happy. And he wants us to be happy just because he wants us to be happy, not because he needs something from us. But he wants us to be genuinely happy. He doesn't want us to be not really happy. You know, you don't want your kid to be happy by shooting heroin, kind of.
Well, I'm happy.
No, it wasn't that kind of happiness. Yes, Prabhu. Very nice. So what should we tell people who want a more personal concept of Krishna than Krishna as a philosophical concept? Well, first of all, that should happen naturally as the anartas get removed, because one's personal relationship with Krishna will start to awaken. And it will awaken on its own. It will just naturally awaken. Just like something like if you eat healthy food and you don't have any disease, you'll naturally move from being a child to being an adult. It will just happen. And a mature way of thinking and adult desires will naturally awaken in you, unless you have some kind of disease, if you just go on living life and eating. So if we go on in bhakti, the same thing should happen, that our mature desire in our relationship with Krishna will awaken. And until that does, it's very difficult to think of Krishna in a personal way instead of as a philosophical construct. Because before that happens, our main motivation for bhakti is philosophical conviction. That's the difficulty. If we want to speed up the process, then don't offend devotees. And just to be safe, don't offend anybody. And then do a lot of reading and hearing about Krishna and associating with people who do see Krishna as a person and not as a philosophical construct. One of the greatest sources of association of people in the Hare Krishna movement who see Krishna as a person and not as a philosophical concept are our children. So if you would like to speed up your process of seeing Krishna as a person rather than as a philosophical idea, hanging around with young children who have been raised properly is a very good way to do that. The children in the Hare Krishna movement, if they are raised properly, and that's a big qualifier, just that they're born in the Hare Krishna movement and they hang around the devotees is not sufficient. But if they're raised nicely, they will see Krishna as a person, just naturally. As talking here about Maharaj Purkhit, exactly, that from his childhood, he saw Krishna like that. And I became aware of this at one time at Prasadam, when I was the only person taking prasadam who wasn't born into the movement. I was with all second and third generation devotees. And they were talking about Krishna as if he lived down the street from them. They were talking about him in such a personal way. And it just sort of kind of shocked me. I hadn't noticed it before. And I thought, wow, you know, most of us who come to the movement as adults, it takes us 15, 20, 25 years before we're really thinking about Krishna like that. But for the children, it's very natural. I give this example all the time. The kids were playing hide and seek in our house, and my granddaughter, not the one who's with me now, my granddaughter Padma, who was 3 years old at the time, she goes up to the deities and she said, "Gornitai, Gornitai, where's Mukunda hiding?" So this is a very natural, because their faith is very simple. The faith is very simple. You know, the downside of having a child's body is that your faith is very simple, and the upside of having a child's body is that your faith is very simple, if that makes any sense. We can mess that up. I mean, a good way to mess that up is exposing your kids to a lot of fictional heroes. You know, exposing them to a lot of Superman and Spider-Man, and that's a good way to mess that up. Because then they'll put Krishna in that category. Where was I? It's so hard for me to remember where I was in the world. Where was I? I was somewhere in the world. I can remember the room clearly and the people clearly, but I can't remember the country I was in. Sorry. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and I don't know what country I'm in. So, seriously, it's like, what side of the bed do I get out of? What country am I in? And the devotees there were saying, they were running a school, and they were saying that they have a problem with the children being respectful to Krishna. You know, training them not to put pitchers on the floor and to follow all the etiquette. And they said, maybe we should train the children first in Brahman and then in Paramatma and then in Bhagavan. And I'm like, no! I said, even if they're sometimes disrespectful, their natural loving relationship with Krishna is more important. So, you've got three, soon to be four of them in your house. Hang out with them. You know, this is the downside of being a householder is you can't just sit around studying the Shastra all day. You have to work at a job. You have to deal with the psychologies of your spouse. You know, male-female psychologies are a little different. You have to deal with the fact that you're kind of associating with a creature from another planet in your house. And you have to deal with the physical needs of the children and all that kind of thing. That's the downsides of householder life. But the upsides of house, every ashram has its upsides and downsides. We tend to look at things, you know, in a very black and white way. You know, this situation has only good things and this situation has only bad things. It's a bunch of nonsense. The upsides of the householder ashram, if you have children, is you have association with people who have natural, spontaneous, personal relationship with Krishna. It's just natural in them. It can get ruined, but it's naturally present in them. And you can sit, I talk about this all the time, you know, you can sit around and with your children and go, oh, there's Agasura. Try doing that with the adults. You know, don't try doing it with the adults. I mean, I've met one or two adults in the Hare Krishna movement who do that. There's one devotee I know in Europe. He came up to me at the end of a class and he said, Urmila, have you heard the news? I'm like, what's that? And he said, Nanda Maharaj was worshipping Lord Shiva and he got swallowed by a snake and none of the cowherd men could get him out even with their flaming torches and it took Krishna's lotus feet to get him out. I'm like, that's really cool, Prabhu. So it'd be nice if we did a little bit more of that in the Brahmachari and Brahmacharini ashram. But anyway, yeah, that's a very good way. Yeah. You have that right there, right at your fingertips. If you get absorbed in your children simply as, you know, do they get something to eat and did I take care of my daughter's arm at the doctor's? If you get absorbed just at that level, then you miss that whole thing. So that's specifically for you since you asked that question. You have the wealth right at your fingertips in your house if you use it that way. Tell them stories. Read stories to them. Try to pick up on that mood from them. Sorry, you guys in the Brahmacharya ashram. But you can also do that with each other, you know. Okay. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to talk with other devotees about Krishna. Don't just keep Krishna consciousness on a philosophical level. That's one of the things in Manashiksha of the donkey urine bath. You know, and that's specifically actually for the renunciates, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Puts it specifically in the nirapeksha category of a donkey urine bath. The renunciates who just, you know, they want to approach Krishna from just the gyan platform. They don't want to approach Krishna from the heart platform. So, I mean, in this verse we have, right, sannyasa karma tri vargikam. So he's sannyasa. You can't see that. It's the next verse. Sorry. Just can't point to it on the board because it ain't there. So he's giving up karma. He's giving up the three elements of material nature, but he's not giving up Krishna Anubhava and Atma Bhavam Dridham. He's not giving up that. That Maharaj Parikit, although he's renouncing the world, he's relishing the emotion of his relationship with Krishna. Something else? Anybody else? Yes. Well, that was my first answer to Dharma Setupu. My first answer was that ultimately, to come to that platform, it has to develop on its own. So, for it to be deep and real, it has to come out from mature bhakti. However, how is it going to come out from mature bhakti? How is it going to mature? What's the process by which it's going to mature? It's by cultivating whatever little bit of it one has in the beginning. This is straight Rupa Goswami, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. The beginning of Krishna consciousness is what? What is our qualification for Krishna consciousness? Well, Shraddha, he talks about in terms of how qualified you are to do Vaidhi Bhakti. Because Vaidhi Bhakti is you're doing bhakti according to the regulation of the scriptures. So how much faith you have in the regulation of the scriptures is going to be your qualification for doing bhakti according to the regulation of the scriptures. Is that very logical? It's like if someone gives you a recipe, how well you follow the recipe depends on your faith in the recipe. If you think, well, you know, I'll substitute walnuts for almonds, and I'll substitute ghee for butter, and I'll substitute buckwheat flour for wheat flour. If you don't have any faith in the recipe, then you may not be able to follow it very well. But as far as bhakti in general, what does Rupa Goswami say is the qualification for starting bhakti in general? Greed, a taste. Sincerity, yeah. That's the whole thing is a taste. And what does that mean? It means it's something emotional. It means it's some experience of God as a person. That's what it means. It may be very, 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 very tiny. I mean, even little children want to become adults. Do you all remember being children, those of you who aren't children presently? And you're just kind of hankering. When am I? Of course, usually we look at just the positive side of being an adult when we're a kid. You know, we think, I'll get freedom. I'll be able to do whatever I want. Well, no, you won't, because you have to pay the bills. But, you know, when you're a kid, you think like that. You think, my mommy and daddy can do whatever they want. No one tells them when to go to bed at night. Nobody tells them what to eat. They can have their cookies first. So I want to be an adult. But my point is that that desire to be an adult is present even in a child. So we can't even begin bhakti, according to Rupa Goswami, if we don't have some emotional connection with Krishna in the very beginning. That is our qualification. That is our qualification. So Prabhupada says, you take that spark and you fan it. And you fan it, and you fan it. The main thing that we're trying to do by our study of philosophy, the reason we're studying philosophy is not to become a gyani. Please, 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 don't study philosophy to be a gyani. It's boring. It's boring. You know, and we're not in this Krishna consciousness so we can be very moral, dharmic people of the world. I mean, we don't want to be sinful people of the world. But we're not studying this philosophy to be moral people of the world. It's not why we're studying it. And we're not studying it so we can manipulate our consciousness, manipulate our life airs, and master this science so that we can gain power. The power to control our senses. Prabhupada says the yogis are enjoying the power of being able to control their senses. It's not why we're doing it. I had this heavy realization that that was why I liked doing a codicy. That it was really cool to say, I've gone without food, water, or sleep for 24 hours. I am the master of the body. I was like, whoa, that wasn't the idea. So we're not, it's not our purpose. Our purpose, according to Krishna, 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in doing sadhana bhakti, is to fall in love with Krishna, to get a desire. So whatever desire you have, okay, it's immature. It's not specific. Fan it, fan it, fan it, fan it, fan it. Use the philosophy to fan it. Use the activities we do in bhakti to fan it. Use your association to fan it. That feeling that Krishna is a person and I have a personal relationship with Krishna. And if you do that, then one day it will naturally mature and one day it will open up and you'll go, whoa, whoa, I love Krishna like that. Is that okay? If you just try to go, if you just say, I am not going to allow myself to have any feelings for Krishna until I am fully mature, then you're not doing bhakti. Then you're doing, at best, you're doing Gyan Mishra Bhakti or Karma Mishra Bhakti or Yoga Mishra Bhakti at best. But you're probably actually doing Karma Yoga or Gyan Yoga or Dhyan Yoga. And Krishna says that'll work, but he says it'll work after a long time with a lot of trouble. So if we Bhaktivinoda identifies this as one of the sources, as one of the kinds of a donkey urine bath, where you think you're getting purified in bhakti and actually you're just getting burning and stinking. So we do want to be careful of that. You know, in the name of not being a sahajiya, not being a sentimentalist, if we try to cut off all of our feelings for Krishna and just be a philosopher, you know, it's just, then you're going to be a philosopher. And what does Prabhupada say here about philosophers? This perfectional stage is attained by a jnani after many, many births. You all know that verse, right? Bahunam gyamanam ante. Bahunam. Many births. The jnanis of the empiric philosophers endeavoring for liberations are thousands of times better than the fruit of workers, but, you know, that's Manusha Namahasri Su. Whereas if we fan that spark of a personal attachment for Krishna, then bhakti can happen very quickly. All of the places where Prabhupada talks about immediately, quickly, easily, are in reference to go to that place. That's the place we want to go. That, of course, is exactly what we are most afraid of doing. Because we're afraid that if I do that, then I'll be able to say this verse of the Shikshastika and mean it, and we're afraid to do that. Then I'll really mean it. Okay, you can do whatever you want with me. And maybe he will. So that's the mood that we want to fan, and that's the very mood that we're shying away from. I'll do everything else. I'll chant, I'll study the books, I'll take prasadam, but I won't awaken my feelings for Krishna. No, 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 no. Because then I might be able to say that verse. And then other people will tell me that I'm illusioned and crazy. And okay? Is that all right? Is that all right? Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.